You're listening to At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast, where we take a look at the story behind some of the biggest trends, themes, and industry in the markets today. I'm Alex Rover from the Fixed Income Strategy Team at JP Morgan. And today's topic is really about shifting views of the Federal Reserve, monetary policy, fiscal policy, and what we can expect in the coming weeks. Joining me on the podcast today are Mike Feroli, our chief U.S. economist, Teresa Ho, our head of short duration strategy, Jay Berry, our head of government security strategy, and Nick Masayunas, who heads up our agency MBS strategy group. So let's kick off our conversation with Mike Feroli. I guess, Mike, the easiest way to start this this conversation about the Fed is just to recap your views on the way forward. I guess besides the policy rate view, you know, what should we be thinking about tapering and about balance sheet reduction? And I guess one of the most asked questions we've had in the past couple of weeks is, you know, how should we be thinking about the terminal rate?
Yeah. Okay. So on the rate view, we after last Friday's employment report, we pulled forward our expectation from liftoff to March and continue to look for a quarterly pace of hikes afterwards. And the reason for pulling forward is simply that, you know, as we heard from Chair Powell after the December FOMC meeting, what precipitated the pivot in the fourth quarter of last year was the surprisingly rapid degree of labor market tightening, and that continued to surprise us in the December report. And so we think the Fed will be similarly minded in viewing the labor market. And why not faster than a quarterly pace? Certainly that is a risk, and I'm sure we're going to get to risk, but in the minutes to the December FOMC meeting, you know, the argument for pulling forward liftoff was in order to maintain actually a measured pace of tightening, and measured in their kind of code language is quarterly. So part of the goal here of going a little earlier is that you can preserve that ability to, you know, monitor the economy as you continue to snug up rates here. So that's a view on the policy rate. On the balance sheet, you know, I think there are, given what we learned in the minutes, I think there are, it's clear that relative to 2017, they are going to go sooner in terms of balance sheet normalization and go faster. And so I think the two open questions are, what does that actually mean? Or what does sooner mean and what does faster mean? We took sooner to mean after the second rate hike that they would begin to allow assets to run off, which in our timeline would probably be the July meeting. And faster, we interpreted to be basically twice as fast as the last time, where the monthly caps in the last episode peaked at $50 billion a month in terms of allowed runoff. We think that'll be about double to $100 billion in this cycle. And for what it's worth, you know, we did get some comments from Fed officials suggesting that we're basically in the right ballpark in terms of those parameters. And we suspect we'll learn more in the minutes to the January meeting, or perhaps even in Powell's remarks at the January meeting. In terms of terminal rate, our best guess is that neutral is around 2 to 2.5 for the funds rate. In a nominal sense. That doesn't mean that terminal has to be neutral. In a normal cycle, terminal is above neutral because you might need to tighten policy or put policy in a restrictive stance and not just in a neutral stance. And that seems like, in our opinion, a pretty reasonable expectation given that the Fed's behind the curve. And the unemployment rate will almost certainly be lower than it is now when we actually get to the neutral policy rate. So that's our best guess, with, of course, a lot of humility around our ability to actually estimate what the neutral rate is.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of sort of moving parts to this. I guess, you know, we haven't really, we're still a few couple weeks out from the January meeting as we're recording this, and we're still getting, you know, a fair amount of Fed speak and commentary from officials, including Powell and Brainard, who had their moments on the Hill this past week. Anyway, it seems like they still have some work to do before they get to the meeting. But at this early stage, what are sort of the reasonable expectations for what we should expect coming out of January?
Yeah, so January, we think, is kind of a placeholder meeting, right? So I think over the past week, the committee has done or Fed officials have done a pretty good job of firming up market expectations for liftoff in March. Today, January 14th is basically the last day before the committee goes into blackout next week ahead of the meeting the week after. So I think they've moved expectations here quite a bit over the past month and are probably pretty happy with where they are now. So, a lot of chatter about could they do something surprise hawkishly in January, since the surprises have all been in a hawkish direction lately. And of course, anything's possible, but I would think no for a few reasons. One, as I just mentioned, they really haven't indicated or hinted at that. And a lot of the hawkish shift we've seen over the past few months has been kind of, hinted at in dribs and drabs. So we don't, we think that they haven't been minded to surprise the market here, and they're going to continue that. I think the other thing is that, we're kind of perhaps coming up to a run of softer data here. We just this morning got a pretty awful retail sales report. And there is a chance that I think that the jobs report, which is going to come after the January meeting, might also be soft. So it might not be an opportune time to kind of surprise with either a hike or a cessation of asset purchases in mid-Feb. I guess the other thing I would say about, stopping short asset purchases in mid-Feb is that it doesn't really, the point of accelerating asset purchases was to get you space on the calendar to lift off without at the same time still buying assets. If you stop short asset purchases in mid-Feb, that doesn't really buy you any extra space, because the next meeting in March is already after asset purchases are scheduled to conclude. But of those two hawkish scenarios, I think the one that would be more likely is that they could just stop short asset purchases in mid-Feb. I think a hike, on the other hand, would be pretty tough to pull off. But a final thing I should say is keep in mind, another reason I think it's kind of a placeholder meeting is that this is going to be, I guess, what you might call an off-cycle meeting, meaning there's going to be no updated dots, no SCP. So we think it should be a pretty quiet meeting.
Well, I mean, you touched on some of the risk, I guess, potentially in the view. I mean, we're seeing a lot of competing theories, banging around the markets. You sort of addressed the idea of January liftoff. 50 basis points on a first hike, I guess, is sort of, since inflation has been running hot, is sort of picked up some chatter. I guess there's a lot of focus on the new board members, since we had them sort of released this week. And I guess sort of other risk out there. And then realizing we have Teresa coming up in a couple minutes here, a lot of conversations around administered rates and sort of how those might set as we go into a liftoff period, maybe how we should think about those. So let me get your reaction to those things.
Okay, so I think on a 50 basis point start, I think if the Fed felt they were that far behind, I think they would prefer to hike every meeting, right? Which would certainly be a lot more hawkish than expectations. I think expectations, both among economists and the market, is broadly similar to ours, which is that they hike once a quarter at the SEP meetings. If they signal they're going every meeting, that would be, and you think that's going to persist, that would be quite a bit more hawkish. And I think that would be the preferred response relative to 50 basis points. 50 basis points, I think, signals, you know, a bit of a panic thing. And I think if they really just want to signal that they're behind, I think you can catch up a lot, you know, pretty in a perhaps a more orderly fashion with hikes every meeting. And again, that does allow you at least to observe how the economy and markets are responding, even if it is going to be more hawkish. In terms of the, I think you also asked about the new governors, Raskin, Cook, and Jefferson. I don't think it's going to be a big change. I mean, first of all, Raskin is going to really focus on bank regulation, and which is what she did in her prior stint at the Fed, and really didn't take much of a lead on monetary policy. Cook and Jefferson are economists, and so they can have their own views. But I think they're going to, you know, lean dovish for sure. But I think what you've seen lately is that even the doves on the committee realize if you're going to preserve maximum employment, which we're probably at now, and we're seeing sort of the fruits of that in wage gains, then you don't want to kind of get too far behind the curve and have to catch up in a disorderly manner. So we do think, even though they're dovish, that a labor-friendly monetary policy at this point would support, you know, normalizing policy in a way that is gradual and non-disruptive. But we don't think it's, you know, that these new board members are going to be so dovish to really alter the course of policy. In terms of administered rates, I would say for the near term, no need to adjust any of the administered rates, with effective around 8 basis points lately. That is, I think, sufficient. Historically, that would be considered sufficiently within the bands, the upper and lower bands of the Fed funds target. So I don't see an immediate need to change administered rates. You know, one administered rate that probably doesn't matter as much for people on this call is the primary credit rate, or formerly known as the discount rate, which now sits at the top of the funds rate target range. Historically, in non-sort of emergency situations, that has been 50 basis points above the top of the range. And since we're kind of getting out of an emergency situation, I would expect that to go back up. But again, I don't think that probably matters a lot for what Teresa's focus on. But yeah, that's what I would think for the very near term.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Hadn't given a lot of thought to the discount rate, but it's a good point. So let's turn now to Teresa Ho and dig in a little bit more to the money markets. So Teresa, I guess in a lot of ways, money markets are really ground zero for the Fed's policy shift. And, you know, we're going to have the shift in the target range and I guess the associated policy rates also. And then down the road, you know, we're looking at balance sheet normalization, you know, which changes obviously both the Fed's assets and liabilities. And, you know, one of the biggest liabilities is obviously sort of the overnight RRP program. And another one is obviously the amount of reserves in the system. And I guess maybe before we dig in, it might just be good to take a couple minutes and recap, you know, where we are in the money markets right now. You know, in particular, sort of how did repo markets do through year end, and sort of how have they evolved, I guess, you know, since the crisis onset in 2020. And so, you know, so we have a base to sort of, you know, talk about, you know, where we go from here.
Sure, Alex. I would say the money markets right now is functioning pretty well, thanks to the RRP facility. We have SOFR trading at 5 basis points above the lower bound of the Fed funds range, and the effective Fed funds rate trading at 8 basis points above. In Fed language, the effective rate is trading well within the target range, which is, you know, something that Feroli just alluded to earlier. So the plumbing in the money markets is working quite well at the moment. And this is in spite of the tremendous growth we have seen in government money market funds, as their assets have grown by over 55% over the past 2 years. Currently, their AUMs are at about $4.2 trillion, which is just substantial. And just to give some context on how big they are, at $4.2 trillion, you know, that's equivalent to the amount of treasuries and agency securities held by all the banks in the United States. So, you know, you can imagine that they just have a substantial amount of liquidity in their portfolios looking for a place to go. And as you may know, usage at the RRP facility was at a record high of $1.9 trillion at year end. 90% of that was for money funds. So, you know, the RRP facility has really served to provide a decent floor for money market rates. You know, it's not perfect as there are still some rates that are trading through RRP, but by and large, the rates have held in thanks to the RRP facility. As for the repo markets, I think they weather year-end quite well. Usually we would see some form of pressures building as we head into year-end or on year-end due to balance sheet pressures. And that just hasn't been happening over the past 2 years, in part because, you know, there is just so much excess liquidity in the markets. But also I think the market as a whole has gradually, you know, gravitated towards using more cleared repo, which helps with dealer balance sheet constraints. Plus, we now have the standing repo facility, which puts a limit as to how far repo rates can back up. So, you know, all of this is helping with the money markets right now. And as a result, it's functioning pretty well, given all these guardrails put in place.
Thanks for that. I guess, you know, thinking about the balance sheet contraction, you know, coming later this year, you know, the implications are, you know, how does it impact, how do we think it impacts, you know, the liability side for the Fed. So what would you sort of anticipate, you know, impact on, say, reserves versus the RRP?
Right. So in general, when the Fed reduces assets on its balance sheet, you know, we should see a commensurate decline on the Fed's liability side. And, you know, which liability will run off first is really the question. And I think in our view, you know, we think reserves will be the first to run off, in part because of the balance sheet constraints that banks continue to face. Over the past year, they have actively tried to shed deposits off of their balance sheets. And I suspect that will continue to take place even as the Fed normalizes. And really, this will continue until we get some sort of SOR relief from the regulatory agencies, but that doesn't seem to be happening anytime soon. And so as that money moves to places like government money market funds, you know, to the extent that we don't see an additional, you know, increase in supply in the money markets, that money will then by extension, you know, presumably shift into the RRP. So in effect, we think reserves will see a faster decline in balances as the Fed normalizes its balance sheet, while the RRP, you know, their balances there should stay pretty elevated as we kind of move on through the cycle.
So Mike had touched on, you know, administered rates, you know, generally a few minutes ago. And I guess, you know, I want to ask you what your thoughts are about, you know, potential changes at the time of liftoff. Are there, it doesn't sound like there are any obvious sort of reasons for a shift, but are we overlooking something?
That's right. I don't think there, you know, are really any good reasons for a technical adjustment at this point. As I said earlier, the current state of the funding markets is working pretty well. You know, the Fed effective is trading kind of well within the Fed funds target range. You know, kind of against this backdrop, we don't really see a reason why the Fed would want to introduce technical adjustments at liftoff and risk upsetting kind of the current plumbing that is working pretty well already. Also, I think there's a decent chance that balances of government money market funds remain elevated. You know, beyond the fact that banks will want to shed more deposits, as I talked about earlier, the spread between deposit yields and money fund yields will also likely widen as the Fed begins its tightening cycle. So this spread divergence will likely drive more flows into money funds. However, you know, on the supply side, we're not anticipating the supply outlook to change dramatically, which would suggest that we should see continued usage of RRP as a source of backstop supply. So all of this would argue for maintaining the current RRP-IORB spread and making sure that short rates do not trade outside of the Fed funds target range.
So finally, Teresa, obviously, you know, we've talked a lot about repo. You know, the other thing that's a big asset class for the government money funds is bills, and there seems to be a lot going on with bills, and we'll explore that with Jay a little bit more in a minute. But what's really going on with sort of bill demand in govy markets, and how do you think that changes as we get through liftoff and rates start to rise?
The demand for bills continues to be strong, and I think that's most evident by the fact that short-dated T-bills are still, you know, trading below the RRP rate. We don't anticipate that to change anytime soon, you know, as cash continues to, you know, remain in government money funds or even go higher. Having said that, I think with the Fed potentially in motion this year, you know, I think money market participants are trying to get a sense of break evens and whether some of the longer dated T-bills are, you know, pricing in their Fed views. And to the extent it's not, you know, I think some of them are happy to stay short duration and hang out in the overnight market for the time being. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Treasury bills curve steepens from here. But again, I don't think that changes kind of the overall picture around the demand for bills. You know, with $1.5 trillion of liquidity at the RRP facility, that demand for bill will continue to be very strong as we move forward.
Thanks, Teresa. Let's turn to Jay Berry now and talk a little bit about government bond supply, and particularly I do want to ask about bill supply. I guess before we get there though, Jay, can we recap our broader views on Treasury supply for 2022?
Yeah, sure, Alex. I'd be happy to. So, you know, I think our thesis for Treasury supply in 2022, even before the change to the Fed balance sheet forecast, was one in which budget deficits were narrowing sharply and likely to be halved this year, creating a condition where the Treasury Department, with its current auction schedule, was significantly overfinanced in its current schedule of coupon offerings. So we saw this started to be addressed at the November refunding, where the Treasury made pretty large-scale adjustments to auction sizes across the curve, but mainly focused in the 2 to 5 year sector. And it's been our anticipation that you'd see another round of similar cuts at the February refunding, same cuts as in November, and then smaller ones in May and August and well, such that the gross supply of Treasury coupons would decline about 920 a year to 2021, and in aggregate, looking for total net issuance of Treasuries this year, just about $1.6 trillion or so, which is only a couple hundred billion slower than last year, but the sharp difference being that we know bills bore the brunt of the downdraft in issuance last year, but we expect sort of bill supply on a year-to-year basis to be relatively stable. So that's kind of been the broad brushstrokes for supply that we've been looking for in 2022. One that gets the wham of the Treasury's debt a little bit longer, which the TBAC had been recommending to Treasury since the middle of last year, but also it ensures, and given the demand dynamics that Teresa talked about, that T-bills stay within the 15% to 20% range of the share of outstanding marketable debt that has been recommended as well. So that's been sort of our broad brushstrokes outlook for supply for this year.
So Jay, I guess I want to keep in mind that you know, we have, you know, the TBAC, you know, has its February refunding meeting coming up in a few weeks, and certainly they're going to be thinking about sort of, you know, auction sizes and distribution across the curve. And so that's a story for down the road. But I guess as a prelude, maybe we should think back about, you know, 2017, the last liftoff. Are there lessons from sort of the debt management side that we should take away from that episode?
I think there certainly are. And when we consider our Fed balance sheet forecast, it would mean there's probably going to be about $200 billion in runoff from the Treasury portfolio this year. And depending on what happens with bills next year, and that's a whole other topic we can get into, upwards of $650 billion in runoff next year as well. So on the margin, because the Fed rolls its holdings over passively at auction as an add-on, the ending of these reinvestments will mean that the Treasury will need to increase its financing to non-Fed private investors. And in 2017, the way that it did this was it increased auction sizes in sort of the 2 to 5 year sector of the curve to accomplish that. And I think that makes sense, mainly because if we think about SOMA runoff, it's an event that's likely to take a couple of years. So it makes sense to finance it at the short end of the curve because it's not permanent funding, it's more cyclical in nature. So interestingly, I think there's some parallels to draw with this current cycle as well. Because if we look at the cuts, the Treasury already announced in November, and what we're anticipating for the rest of this year as well. It's interesting that Treasury made their biggest cuts at the short end of the curve in twos through fives. So, you know, some of that is to facilitate WAM extension, but I also think some of that was knowing that down the line, it would have to contend with SOMA runoff and increased financing needs. And using the example of 2017, that could be very well the way that they'd like to address it. Now, I think there are a few differences this time around. The first is, as we mentioned, the Treasury is currently overfinanced and in all likelihood needs to cut auction sizes more. So the introduction of SOMA runoff this year perhaps means fewer of those cuts down the line. But second, we also don't know how the Treasury and the TBAC are thinking about this. Back in 2017, the TBAC was tasked to sort of look into this in May of 17, about 4 months before balance sheet runoff was announced. So we haven't seen anything from the Treasury Department on this so far, and clearly because this has evolved so quickly since the last refunding in November. But I mean, it wouldn't surprise me that if this is something that comes up, you know, relatively in short order to sort of consider. So I think, you know, those are the key differences. We know what happened in 2017. The difference being this time around, it probably means just fewer cuts. And I think we're going to learn more in a few weeks' time on this. But if anything, I think this would, you know, suggest that the risks to our forecast are fewer cuts to auction sizes later this year than we had previously forecast. And if that happens, in effect, it means that there's more net issuance to the public at the short end of the curve in twos through fives, which would previously have seen the biggest brunt of the supply cuts.
So let's finish up with bills, which is sort of where we started the conversation. You know, knowing what we know now, you know, what should we be thinking about bill supply? You know, when are we likely to see it in the markets? And any other thoughts you have?
I think that's one of those known unknowns, Alex. So, you know, we've seen T-bill issuance rise cyclically and really short term over the course of the last 6 weeks since the debt ceiling has been dealt with. And that's really been to facilitate a return of the Treasury's general account back to more normal levels to allow the Treasury to withstand loss of access to markets. And now it's around $500 billion. So it probably needs to go up another $150 billion or so, which would mean over the near term, more net positive bill issuance in the coming month to 6 weeks or so. But beyond that, the outlook for bill supply, you know, I think we know that the Treasury is targeting that T-bill should be anywhere between a 15 and 20% share of the debt outstanding. As of the end of last year, they were about 16.5 to 17%. So in the middle to kind of lower end of that range, you know, I think we look at the work done at the November refunding. It indicates that Treasury would be certainly welcome to its moving slightly above the top end of that range if it needed to. And given the conditions that Teresa talked about, perhaps there is some sort of scope to increase T-bill issuance further. But I think sort of threading the needle right here, if we're looking for less cuts to auction sizes because of the SOMA runoff, that would implicitly drive down the T-bill share of the total marketable debt outstanding. So I think to iterate on this further, this would probably indicate that the risks to T-bill issuance from our baseline forecast are somewhat higher, to make sure that they remain within this range and not at the lower end of this range, particularly given the demand side dynamics that Teresa has talked about. So, you know, we're looking for net positive T-bill issuance over the near term. And I think that, you know, as we look forward, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a risk that it's somewhat higher than that.
Thanks, Jay. Last but not least, let's turn to Nick and let's dig in a little bit to the agency MBS market, which I think maybe gets a little bit lost in the shuffle here that, you know, with all the conversation around Treasury. So Nick, what are we thinking around sort of agency MBS as, you know, the Fed policy shifts in the market? And I guess, you know, initially let's talk a little bit about what the rate hikes are going to do and then think a little bit more about balance sheet runoff.
Sure. So, you know, with respect to rate hikes, as far as they drive the overall, you know, curve higher, I think that can have an impact on, you know, on general prepayments. But generally, now that we've gotten to a much higher level of the mortgage rate, you're only looking at maybe 20, 25% of the mortgage market that's actually in the money to refi. So the real focus has been around balance sheet runoff. And that has been the main driver of mortgage performance over the past couple of weeks and you know, even over the past couple of months at this point, we're now about 30 basis points wider than where we were at the beginning of November on some of the production coupons. And over the past 2 weeks, that widening has really accelerated. And, you know, the reason for that, I think, has been that more and more Fed speakers have come out and talked up sooner and faster QT. And that's made the picture for MBS look bleaker to the point where investors have been actively considering the worst case scenarios for MBS. And those, you know, could involve things like MBS payoff reinvestment into treasuries or even outright sales of MBS. These are obviously not our house view, but these are the kind of conversations I've been having with investors recently. And the reason for this focus is that runoff of MBS is particularly painful for the sector. There's not just that first order demand effect of them not being there to absorb net supply or at least absorb their own paydowns, but there's the additional fact that the Fed's purchases currently remove the worst to deliver collateral from our TBA market. So without them locking up those bonds, the convexity of our TBA market gets worse over time, which would require prices to fall from where they are now. And on top of that, there's another demand factor to consider. So if QT drains reserves and that reduces pressure on deposit growth at banks, that means that you're potentially taking out or at least reducing another source of demand for MBS. Banks have been the other big buyer of MBS after the Fed this year, and they've generally been willing to buy at lower spreads than money managers would touch the product at. So if the Fed stops reinvesting and banks have relatively less appetite, you start needing relative value investors to step in and absorb what is looking like another strong year of supply. So even though rates have backed up and refi volumes have declined, the housing market is still on a tear. And so purchase activity is going to be driving a high level of net issuance this year. And so, you know, if we do see a pace of net issuance that could be, you know, $700 billion in the sector for the year, you're going to need money managers to probably absorb a couple hundred billion of net supply. And they typically want to do that at much higher levels. The last time that we had an environment like this was probably after the last QE3 tapering experience. And so in 2018, when you were seeing the Fed let their MBS portfolio run off, you got to OESs that were in the positive 30 to 40 basis point range. And right now, we're closer to positive 15 basis points. So we do think it's possible that we get out to that kind of level of spreads by the end of the year. The question is whether there will be more Fed speak that gets more hawkish on mortgages specifically that could precipitate a faster widening. If there's not, and we've kind of seen the worst of it, I do think there's still a lot of bank cash that could be deployed and help absorb some of that additional supply. I think certainly banks would have been happy to buy at these kind of spreads just a few months ago. And so while things are evolving on their loan books and they're getting some better demand there, there's still probably an appetite to buffer some of the widening.
Thanks for sharing those thoughts, Nick. And I think that's a good place for us to stop today. Stay tuned for more episodes of At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast Series. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2022, JP Morgan Chase & Company, all rights reserved. This episode was recorded on January 14th, 2022.